Chuck and Julie, bringing you the truth straight up.
I'm Julie Hayden. I'm working at
an Emmy-winning former investigative reporter, a highly successful trial attorney, and publisher of a major Denver area newspaper. They've been partners as talk show hosts and in marriage, as parents for over 10 years, providing thought-provoking information, opinion, and entertainment live, local, and interactive. Everyone's voice is always welcome on the Chuck and Julie Show.
Well, hello, everyone. Chuck Bonner, Julie Hayden, the Truth Straight Up, brought to you by...
Brought to you by AmericanCitizenPress.com and Denver Cenogenics and Dr. Julie McCallan. Chuck has now lost, almost 15 pounds. It's great, thanks to a diet help with Dr. Julie McCallan. So a lot to talk about today. Chuck wants to give his update in a little bit on the Amber Heard case. He's still obsessed. Obsession continues.
It'll continue for weeks because it's not going to be over. They're going to take a little break and then more action. So
Keep your head in the screen. And we got the Supreme Court, obviously, Ash Epp coming up on exposing and expelling rhinos. But wanted to start off today, as promised, with John St. Augustine. He's a former El Paso County Sheriff's Commander and investigator. And to cut to the chase right away, he worked with Lou Schmidt on the JonBenet Ramsey case. Lou Schmidt was hired by the Ramsey family to look into it. And as we told you Monday, Jared Polis has agreed, and I suspect it's a done deal. Otherwise, he wouldn't have issued the statement he did. Has been asked by John Ramsey to hire an independent agency or appoint an independent agency to review, to do some new DNA testing. And this was revealed in Las Vegas, I think in a very public way. They've got thousands of signatures on a petition. And again, I think that Polis wouldn't have agreed to review it if he didn't intend to do it. So let's bring in John St. Augustine, who is, and John, I wanted to ask you, because you have been kind of working on this all along. And I know you guys have had meetings with the Boulder police and who apparently keep saying they're going to do something and never do, right? Which is kind of what led to John Ramsey's recent request. Is that right?
Yes, ma'am. Yes, ma'am. But first off, I just want to tell you and Chuck, thank you for having me on.
Of course. Thank you for your time.
Yeah. So, this whole thing with the DNA, I have to be honest with you guys, this has been going on for some time, Chuck and Julie. You know, the family has made multiple requests over the last, 20 plus years. I mean, we're talking, this is year 26, this December, yeah. 26 years. And, it's no surprise that the case continues to be where it's at, because to be honest with you, nothing is being done.
Right.
The narrative has been from the very beginning that the family, was involved in the murder of their, their daughter, either their brother did it or mom or dad did it. And, I think the biggest problem that we have as investigators is to have that tunnel vision, right? I mean, remember, right, the role of an investigator is nothing more than to gather facts. And this request that's been made recently regarding the DNA is really something that should have been done years ago, right? And as I shared with you, Julie, there's things that have gone on over the years that it's just mind blowing. Like, why weren't these items tested? And so we have to ask ourselves, at what point do we say, look, enough is enough. Let's go back. Let's go through these facts. Let's actually go back and do some real testing and find out who was involved in this murder.
Well, and to let folks know how important this is. And this is, I think this holds true no matter whether you're in a Ramsey's did it or an intruder did it camp. So talk to me a little bit about, there was DNA testing done, and the DNA has improved over the years, but DNA testing was done on three key things I'd like you to talk about: the underwear that JonBenet was wearing, the long johns that she was sort of wearing as pajama bottoms over the underwear, and then under her fingernails. And they got DNA. And can you tell us what did that DNA sample, the test, come back as?
So to kind of, let's rewind a little bit, right? Back to 1996, 97. So December 26th, this is when six-year-old JonBenet, is found in her home there in Boulder, 755 15th Street. They find her body. They do the autopsy. They get their DNA, there are different pieces of evidence to analyze for DNA. So this is actually forwarded to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation for analysis. So in January, there was actually a report that comes back that they were able to find find DNA on her underwear at the time and under her fingernails. Now, when you mentioned the Long Johns, that actually didn't come about until about 2008.
Right.
Now, what they've been able to find as a result of those three pieces that you were referencing is that all three of those evidence items, the DNA found on that came from the same source, meaning that it came from the same individual.
Let me clarify that, because I want to be certain on that, because it's my understanding with DNA testing that it can be anything, depending on the quality of the sample, can be everything from specific enough to say to distinguish between me and my daughter, mm-hmm. or vague enough to be a Caucasian female. That's so correct. How specific is when you say it came from the same source, how specific is that?
So it was my understanding on the testing that the sample on her underwear, that there wasn't enough loci, there wasn't enough sampling to generate a good profile from that. But they were able to generate a good profile from under her fingernails. And then later, Bode Technology, who's a pretty well-known laboratory here in the U.S., was able to take her Long Johns and develop a good profile. So what happens is, once this profile is developed, what law enforcement has as part of their tool set is a DNA database.
Right.
It's much like what you hear about with fingerprints with aphids, right? It's CODIS, which is the Combined DNA Index System. Then what happens is it's the responsibility of that law enforcement agency, if they have an unknown sample, to then see if there is a known sample from CODIS that it can match up with.
Okay.
And what we know right now is that, you know, there has been no match to anything in CODIS, but we have to use some caution here when we're talking about this, because remember, this happened almost 26 years ago.
Right.
So CODIS had not been developed, really. I mean,
Which is why the genealogy testing. But let me, though, just to clarify, and then, you know, Chuck has some questions too, but just to clarify. Sure. But the profile they developed, you said it's specific enough that they can tell it came, and it was not the Ramses, basically it excludes them, as I understand it.
That is correct.
But it came from the same source. And so here's why I think what people need to understand, why this further testing is so important, because the police narrative has been that these were just sort of random contaminations, right? It could have come from somebody at the factory or contaminated by the fingernail clippers that they use to get with the fingernails, et cetera, et cetera. I mean, I got to agree with you. That seems kind of hard to imagine, but it seems to me that if you found a similar match of that DNA on other pieces of evidence, well, that would be. So what are, and I was stunned when we talked earlier, when you told me some of the stuff that they have not tested, because Boulder right. police make it sound like, well, we've tested DNA all over the place for years. What are the pieces of DNA that you consider particularly significant that haven't been tested for DNA yet?
Yeah, you know, and as you mentioned, we talked earlier about this. And one of the reports that I had brought up to you was actually the laboratory report from Bode Technology from back in 2008. And I can tell you, just looking at the report, that, you know, there was the ligature from her neck, the broken paintbrush handle, a ligature from her wrist, and a pair of what they called Wednesday panties that had never been tested. In fact, in the report, it actually says on page 2 of 4 that samples 1, 2, 3, and 4, which is what those samples were that I was telling you about, were not processed at this time. But they give no explanation as to why it wasn't processed, right? And something that close to her, right? From an investigative standpoint, I would want to know, you know, what if anything came from that? You know, it's no different than to kind of put it in another forensic standpoint. Like if we look at something like ballistics, or let's just say we look at something like fingerprints, if you have 20 shell casings at a shooting, do you only test one or two of them? Or should you test all 18 of them?
Well, particularly when you don't have any idea who did it.
That's right. Especially when you don't know who did it. And also, you know, if it's something maybe gang related, you don't know if there's multiple shooters. You don't, if you have a murder in a home and you have multiple footwear impressions or fingerprints, like who else could have been in that home that could potentially have been a co-defendant, right? Maybe not carried out the murder, or maybe did carry out the murder. The bottom line is, as an investigator, it's our responsibility to get those facts. And why that hasn't been done, Julie and Chuck, I don't know. It doesn't make any sense to me. And like you said, whether you believe the Ramsey did it or you believe that an intruder did it, regardless, you still want to get this stuff tested.
Right. Right. Okay. Do you have anything?
Yeah. I mean, I guess I know why it wasn't tested.
Please tell me, Chuck, because I really would like to know. Okay. 26 years later.
You may idealistic say investigator is just simply supposed to look at all the facts and you know, look at things that are against his conclusions and for his conclusions. But that's not the way human beings work. And it's no different for attorneys. You get a case and you find all these things that help your case. You tend to discard the things that don't help your case. That's and right. Usually you have to get somebody to come in and say, there's a big flaw here. You better address it.
That's right.
And particularly if opening it up is going to potentially hurt the conclusion you've come to, which is that it's a family and supports its intruder. That's the last evidence you want. It's on the bottom of your 30-year pile, never to come up to the top. And that's just the way human beings work. So I think your motion to the governor is a good one. I mean, saying, look, you know, just give it to an independent lab. Their family's willing to pay for it, so it doesn't cost anything. He doesn't really have a dog in the fight.
Right. But publicity. We talked about that publicity. The other day.
Yeah, and so I think all of that leads to why they won't do it, or it's not important to them. They have other ones they consider more important. But it's going to be, if it does show a consistent pattern, it's going to be hell for them of saying, well, haven't you done anything for 26 years?
Yeah, right. Yeah, but you know, Chuck, I mean, you being an attorney,
right?
You know, right? I mean, this is in law school 101. They tell you that as prosecutors, your role is what? Your role is to seek justice.
Well, I can tell you the one thing prosecutors are not doing and never done, as you well know now.
Oh, yes, sir. Yes,
you
sir.
You now well know that they don't care about doing justice. They care about getting convictions.
Yes.
And you got to be in the middle of that where the prosecutors treated you like garbage. So
yeah, nothing worse than being charged with kidnapping somebody you never met.
Yeah, exactly.
That's exactly. Tell me if I'm wrong here, but aren't that some of the two of the guys who are now commanders of the Boulder Police Department were among some of the original investigators, right? So it's not like this is this whole completely new group of people there. Am I right there?
Yeah. And see, that's the problem when you're dealing with an investigation like this, is that you really need somebody who has not lost their objectivity. You know, when you have leadership, you know, Trujillo and Gossage, who are, you know, I think Trujillo is a commander of investigations and Gossage is a deputy chief. I mean, you got to remember, right? I mean, what those individuals have believed from the very beginning that the family had something to do with it. And, you know, I got to be careful too, to maintain my objectivity and knowing, you know, that I've been on this case for 26 years. But, you know, what I would tell you is, you know, the worst thing you can do in the law enforcement side of this is to not go out and gather the facts. And to me, this request is something that is very simple. You know, the results are the results. If, like you said, the DNA comes back and it ends up tying up with one of the family members and it's unexplainable, then, you know, the family has an issue. If it ends up linking to somebody else and it happens to link up with the items that we have talked about,
right?
The underwear, the fingernails and her long johns, then I would tell you that's something that is pretty powerful evidence.
Oh, it is. I mean, because as you said, it's hard to explain. And again, I got to confess here, I've long been in sort of more of the Ramsey's did it, although this new DNA thing was making me, I guess, forcing me to be more open-minded. But then I also had to stop and think, John, after talking to you, all of my information and all of everyone's information for a long time, and this has largely come from police sources. And so their explanation of it, and again, their explanation of this DNA in the underwear, long johns, and under the fingernails is that somehow it was contaminated or reared random contaminations. Okay, maybe, but let's go ahead and do. But if you find the same DNA on the paintbrush that was used as the garrote and to sexually assault her, if the same DNA is found on the rope that was used to garrote her and around her wrist, well, that becomes a little bit more. That becomes, as you said, pretty powerful evidence. And what are some of the other things that you guys think should be tested? And then we'll get into the genealogy stuff that should be tested that hasn't been tested.
Well, I can tell you there were over 1,000 items that were collected during the course of the investigation. And what I can tell you is probably less than 10 to 20% of that has probably been actually tested. You know, the thing is I think this investigation from the very beginning, if it fit the Ramsey family, then I think they were more willing to test something that maybe was linked to the family, like Chuck was saying.
Yeah.
If it's something that maybe was exclusionary, it had some kind of exclusionary, right? It was exculpatory evidence. I don't think that they were as willing, right? To test that evidence. And
because
they had nothing to do with it.
Right.
Yeah.
Right.
You just cannot do that. And, you know, that's, I think, why we're looking at a case that is, you know, 25 years old unsolved, is because we have not opened our eyes to what the possibilities are today with technology. I mean, you can look, you know, we talked about this, Julie.
Right.
You know, you can look in California with the deputy who was involved in the Golden State killings. Right.
Right.
And here we are we're talking about a guy who was in law enforcement. I can assure you that nobody in the very beginning probably thought that somebody in law enforcement was responsible for those murders. But now fast forward to 2019, 2020, right now, all of a sudden, they have a lot of new technologies. And the biggest thing there is that law enforcement was willing to explore,
right?
Was willing to explore it. And look what happened. They were able to get a hit. They were able to corroborate that, you know, this evidence is in fact coming from this individual. They were able to conduct an investigation without him, you know, this individual knowing, D'Angelo, knowing that where he was, where these murders happened. They were able to put together an established timeline to show that he was in these locations. And really, that's what needs to happen, is that we've got to bring some objective people into this investigation, much like, you know, what we've talked about with Clements. There's got to be, look, let's wipe the slate clean. I'm not going to let anything influence my decision-making except the facts.
Right, and bring that in.
And bring that in.
Let me ask you this. It's the part I have that, you know, I haven't studied it and done everything else like Julie, but when I was younger, I took graphology classes, which is a study of handwriting. Mm-hmm. And ostensibly, whoever did the deed wrote a draft ransom note and then an actual ransom note that was ran a page or longer.
Uh-huh.
And I've looked at her handwriting,
right.
And to me, it seems to be a match.
Well, and then let me explain that, Chuck, because I don't know if you know all the specifics with that. So the person who did the analysis of the handwriting involving all the parties, meaning John Ramsey and Patsy Ramsey, were well-renowned experts. People like Howard Ryle, Leonard Speckin. These are guys that work for the Secret Service and the federal government. And I will tell you, both of those individuals said that the handwriting did not match anybody in the family. Then you look to Chet Yubowski, who was the CBI examiner. And I will tell you, Chet Yubowski. So when you're looking at handwriting, right, you look at whether it's improbable, probable, or highly probable. That's
right.
Kind of the three phases of what they have, or the three distinctions.
Right.
And what they said in this writing of the ransom note in comparison to Patsy's writings was that Chet Yubowski said there's a probability, but not that it was highly probable. In fact, he says, but it falls short of us saying that she definitively wrote the note. So you have all of these experts who either say improbable or maybe probable, right? But not highly probable. And we're also talking about a science, as you probably well know, this is no different than polygraphy. Right. It's not something that really rises to the level.
It's not like DNA.
It's not like DNA. It's not like ballistics. It's not like fingerprints. Right. It's not like computer forensics. It's not like Mark Poff testifying
right.
about call detail records.
Right.
Right? It's not like any of that.
I can tell you, if you have what is several pages of handwriting, and handwriting is very hard to disguise over a long period of time. I mean, it is very hard to disguise.
It is.
And especially if you're writing page after page of it.
Right.
And it should be that one of the two is true. One of the two should be able to be determined without.
Well,
you don't know anything about
graphology. No, I don't, but I do know, though, from it.
Well, let me finish.
Okay.
You can get a graphologist to say anything you want. I mean, you just like you can get any expert to say what you want. But I'd love for that evidence to be taken out to independent, non-confirming sources to either say, no, this is not, you know, Patsy, whose handwriting it does look like, definitely not John's and not the other ones. And I'd love to see that taken out, because I can hire an expert tomorrow who will say it definitely is, and I can hire an expert tomorrow who says it definitely isn't.
That's correct.
And that your guys work for the Secret Service for the federal government these days is an indication that they suck. They're criminals.
And Stephen is saying, let Chuck finish. Well, and this goes back
But I hope maybe if this comes back and it shows there's an intruder that they take it out to two or three who have nothing. You don't tell them, well, you know, who's paying the bill, but have them analyze it.
Well, and I go back to, again, and I want to talk about a little bit of the genealogy again with the DNA testing, because so folks, if you haven't, the DNA technology has changed significantly from 1996 to today. And as you pointed out, John, one of the things the Boulder police would say is, well, we ran it through the database and we didn't get any matches. But like you pointed out, they weren't doing that much DNA gathering back in 1996. And so there's this whole news area where law enforcement has been using. And that's all these, 23andMe, the genealogy tests that are going out there. And right. It seems to me that, but the Boulder police haven't done that either, right? They haven't run this DNA sample or in any way tried to compare it. They keep saying, oh, that's a great idea, right? But they don't do it compared to these other genealogy databases.
You know, and again, they may have said that they've done this. The problem is that, I guess what my issue is when it comes to DNA, is why would there be any resistance? To me, the response from the Boulder Police Department should have been this. Look, we're always looking, you know, in this case, we've kept it active. We're always, we're always encouraging the public to get involved in any leads that may link to the killer or killers in this case. But there's nothing really for us to lose in testing the DNA. And oh, by the way, here's what we have done of the 1,000 items,
right?
Here's the items that have been tested. They don't necessarily have to tell us what the results are, but at least show that, hey, we submitted, this number of items to the Colorado Bureau of Investigation, to Bode Technology, to, Genentech, whatever the laboratory is. At least say, look, we've done it. We've sent these items off.
Right.
And that way, they can at least show the public that they're being proactive, that they are trying to find out ways to get to the bottom of this case. Is this only a DNA case? I think we have to be very careful not to put all of our eggs in the DNA basket. We got to look at other things that were going on in that crime scene, like a stun gun, like a taser, like the garrote, like the evidence inside of the suitcase, right? Like Chuck said, the handwriting. There's a lot of different forensic disciplines that have gotten so much better over the years that nobody on that side of the camp, on the law enforcement side, has really sought out to really get to the bottom of this. There's a reason why this case is unsolved.
And
it's
because Stephen indicates, and I certainly believe it to be true, every time you test a sample, you have to destroy part of the sample.
Yes, potentially. So a lot of it can be consumptive, and I understand that. But the thing is, you can't tell me that all thousands of these items, if they've never been tested, it's not consumptive. And there's ways of making it to where it's not consumptive. In the old days, Chuck, I will tell you, when I worked the Ashley Gray murder in downtown Denver, I don't know if you guys remember. You might have.
I covered that.
Yeah. So you remember, right? Mr. Morris, Ken, the father. Right. Was involved in that. The father's friend was involved.
The father's friend was the guy.
Right? Morris was, I believe, the guy's last name. I worked that case. And I remember when they did that DNA, if you remember, she had two pairs of shoes. One was her older sister's shoe. There was her underwear. There was a shirt that she was wearing. And they had to cut out samples of where they had blood that they matched up with the suspect. That, when Chuck's talking about that, those particular tests are consumptive. But, when you're swabbing things now, there's ways to still maintain the integrity of that evidence. And really, that's what it's about right now. We're not talking about, saliva. We're not talking about blood. We're not talking about seminal fluid. We're talking about items where people grabbed it potentially. And by doing that, these epithelial cells that they've left behind. And what we have found is like the more force that you apply towards an object, the more of these skin cells you leave behind. So we may get lucky, right?
Well, and here's the thing. And here's where I come down, though, too, John. It's like, it's been 26 years, right? So it's not
like they've just been waiting.
It's not they think that there's going to be some suspect come along and they're just waiting to do that. And I think in this case in particular, the DNA would be huge because it was such a cluster that to try to prosecute this case would be a nightmare under any circumstance. But I think if you have DNA, and like I say, it's like, do it. And then you can turn around and say, there was no DNA. There was no DNA. DNA on the ligature. There was no DNA on the suitcase handle. There was no DNA. And then you know, and then you move on. To me, I do think, and it's not even like they can argue about time, because you could just submit this to a private lab and say, you know, it's a cold case. It's not like we're, you know, and it has to be next week and you have to drop everything else. I guess I just come down on, as somebody who's covered this forever, I was stunned when you started going through all the things that hadn't been tested. It's like, why on earth not? You know? And
famous case in Kansas where they're demanding for 5-6 years that they test the DNA, because when the DNA came up, the testing techniques weren't good enough to do it. And the DA fought it. And then when the judge said, well, you know, you sure? And he goes, okay, yeah, test it. I don't care. And the DNA came up so that the person convicted was not the person, identified another person. The prosecutor still refused to vacate the verdict. Yeah. He was sure. Right. He didn't care that the real murderer had been caught.
And, you know, Chuck, to go back to what you were stating earlier, it's to get those convictions, you know, to get that notch on their belt.
Yeah.
And it shouldn't be about that. It should be about what is justice? What the truth?
You're dealing with human beings.
And John, let me ask you this. Jacob has a point. He says, Stephen says, Leo, I think the Boulder police did such a poor job of securing the crime scene and collecting evidence that there's limited evidence to test. Let me ask that, sort of taking a spin off of it. Is it possible that that's something else they don't want to acknowledge, is that they have totally screwed up securing the evidence in this case, and they don't want to have to say, oh, ligature rolls. It's here somewhere, you know. Oh, well, it's in this like paper bag with our lunch. I mean, is that possible too? Do you think that they're trying to cover potentially something up there?
I think there's no denying that they messed up the crime scene. I mean, you know, if you just look back to when the initial call came in, Julie, you and I talked about this.
Right.
You know, there were three police officers on scene when that 911 call was made. What a lot of people don't realize is that they actually went into the home and they searched this 6,700 square feet Tudor in Boulder, right? Not once, but twice. And by just chance, right? By just chance, which I don't understand, they didn't open the door where JonBenet Ramsey's body was behind. The other thing that was a huge mistake in this case that a lot of people don't understand is that when Linda Arndt, who was the detective on scene, at around 10 o'clock, if you remember in the ransom note, it said something about, we will call you between 8 and 10 a.m. right tomorrow about instructions on what to do with this $118,000. Well, what happens is that she actually tells John Ramsey to go look for things out of the ordinary. That would never happen in any other agency. All the stars have to be aligned the right way for me to tell somebody who potentially could be a suspect to go look for things out of the ordinary.
Well,
the thing you need to do is secure that crime scene, get everybody out of it so that you can preserve whatever evidence is on
that. Well, that would be, in my experience, and covering a ton of these crimes because the Ramseys called their minister. I mean, they had friends over. Mm-hmm. I mean, it was like a ton of people wandering around that house. Normally, they get all of those people out, they separate them, they stick them, they take them down to the police department and talk to them. If they think there's going to be a ransom call, then maybe they handle that differently, but you could forward the phones or whatever. But yeah, I agree with you. The fact that everybody's wandering around and nobody's separated, nobody's sequestered, nobody's even being questioned at this point is insanity.
Well, can they tell from the DNA they have whether the DNA matches up with a male or a male with,
they have been able to determine that it does match a male.
Okay.
I will tell you that of the items that they have tested, it comes back to a male.
Okay.
But again, law enforcement's not obligated to give us any of these results.
Right.
But I will tell you, they're not helping themselves out by, you know, making this a fight to go out and gather facts. The best thing they could do is just go out, test all these items, figure out if there's any DNA profiles developed from these evidence items. And if there is, who does it match up with? Who does it not match up with? And that's going to kind of tell you a pretty, you know, at least a story of who you can include and exclude.
Well, and here's the thing, and I know we got to let you go here, but and also finally, to me, it would seem like if it, because they've released information sort of piecemeal all along anyway, I don't see at this point, unless they all of a sudden be like, oh my God, it's like Bill who lives right at this address and all the DNA matches him, I could see then you might want to keep it quiet, right?
Sure.
But sure. if you don't have a match and if you don't know, I mean, it just seems to me, it doesn't hurt to come back, depending on what they find out.
Yeah, here's the thing. They've believed from day one that it's the Ramsey family.
Right.
So you go get all these items tested and it reveals that it's the Ramsey family. Imagine if that was the case, that they would be out doing it right away.
Yeah. And
so my thing is just get it tested. Figure out whose DNA, if there's a profile, the technology has evolved to a point now where we can really just literally from touch DNA can get a profile. So let's go develop a profile from all of these items and look at the case objectively. You know, whether you're on the intruder camp or whether you're on the Ramsey camp, my thing is from an investigative standpoint, from a cop perspective, you should not worry about whether it's an intruder or not. You should worry about gathering the facts and let the facts tell you who did it.
All right. Well, listen, I think we'll stay in touch because I get a feeling Polis is going to act on this sooner rather than later once the abortion stuff dies down. And so we'll see what happens. John, thank you so much for your time.
Thanks, John.
I sure appreciate it.
Good seeing you all. Thank you again for everything you do. Appreciate it.
Well, thank you, too. Bye-bye. Thank you.
Thank you.
Yeah. He says, yeah, Mark says Polis should have you run the investigation, a true independent investigator. Although I got it, Mark. No, he can't. He was with Lou Smith. So no.
That's right. Thank you. Like,
and then Peter Boyle's run the other one. So, all right, you guys. All right, everybody. Thank you for those great comments. Chuck is now where we've got Ash Epp is going to be joining us on Zoom here. Oh, she's here.
But one second before.
Before she goes, Ash, Chuck has to do his two minutes or 2 seconds on the Amber Heard, Johnny Depp
I've
trial.
I've been watching the Amber Heard trial obsessively today, and Amber came on, and I always wondered why the British judge said, you know, I find everything that he beat her endlessly and everything else. Once she comes on, it's one of two things: one is a monster, and the other is just a pathological liar. And it could be, you know, you get to choose which one of the two. I mean, at this point, I think she's a pathological liar, but it's clearly the judge over in England thought that he was a pathological liar. But it's fascinating. And she's a very good actress. And Julie won half the bet because the first.
I said she was going to cry in the first 45 minutes.
Well, she didn't cry, but she teared up enough for it to be a semi cry. And so I've got the fourth hour where she totally breaks down. So I still could win half the bet. But right now she's ahead. But we'll keep you posted.
All right, now though, we're happy to have with us Ash Epp from Ash in America, one of the newest columnists at the Glendale Cherry Creek Chronicle as well. But Ash in America is, you've got all kinds of columns up. And Ash, I wanted to bring you up because you've been doing a great job talking about, I've been saying it as exposing and then expelling rhinos from the party. And I think first I want to get your take on what happened in Ohio and Indiana. I mean, you know, the Trump endorsed people won and the rhinos are gnashing and wailing their teeth, you know, about that. But your take on sort of the primaries yesterday.
Sure. And thanks for having me.
Sure.
So I think it's really interesting because there is a narrative about the primaries, particularly in Ohio with J.D. Vance and the Trump endorsed candidates there. The grassroots election integrity people are very unhappy with Trump's endorsements. So what I find really interesting about, and that's broadly, not just in Ohio, right? It's there's a theory going on that Trump is endorsing rhino candidates for some sort of purpose. This is like a third divide now.
Right. Yeah.
So it's interesting, but I guess my take is, the most interesting conversations are happening on the right. The most really critical examinations of what's true are happening on the right. And so I think President Trump still has quite a lot of sway when it comes to who people are going to vote for. There's still a lot of people that that trust his recommendation. There was a poll that came out on Rasmussen yesterday about that President Trump, and I forget the number of Joe Biden's, but it was, you know, 36% of likely voters nationally said that they a Trump endorsement of a candidate would be important to them. That's an important
criteria. Yeah, and Biden, it was like no one even cared.
And Biden, much less. Yeah.
Well, after my own side, I mean, I thought J.D. Vance was a great pick. Other people, Ted Cruz, Club for Growth, neither of which I give a great high mark to, had endorsed Mandel, and Mandel had a lot of problems. But I think Oz in Pennsylvania is a strange pick because he doesn't seem very conservative. And there are other ones. And part of a way to kill your endorsement power is to back people that really don't match your profile. And that's what Sarah Palin started doing. I mean, she for a while had a huge sway, and then she started endorsing people that really didn't match up at all, and all that sway went away. But right now, there's nobody else you can really trust. I mean, Trump, you know, he also likes people who are famous. He likes famous people. I think Oz got the famous person pick, but he's certainly better than anybody else out there, at least at the moment. So
Mitch McConnell.
Yeah. Mitch McConnell does it. It's great.
Well, right. I think it does carry sway. The J.D. Vance pick in particular, I think I would liken, from what I've heard, right? And I talk to grassroots people all over the country every day as part of my job. And so I would liken it to if Trump were to come into our primary and endorse Heidi Ganahl. Right. Yeah. And Heidi, I've met Heidi. I like her. I've met her husband. I've, spent some time with her. I have nothing poor to say about her, but the momentum and the grassroots swell right now is with Lopez or with Danielle, right? Depending on who you ask.
And that's what, let me ask you about that, because here again, I guess just like I kind of have fun watching the Democrats get all excitable about Elon Musk and Twitter, it is kind of interesting watching the establishment Republicans in Colorado get all freaked out about the assembly and what happened there. And if that wasn't freaking them out enough, they are totally freaking out about Danielle Neuschwager, who did not make it on the assembly, the GOP assembly for governor, saying she's going to run as with a third party. And they're freaking out about that. And you had, talk about your column, your April 28th column. I mean, you propose, I'll be honest, I'm not so sure I totally agree with it, but I sure think it's intriguing.
Sure. So my husband is a saint. April 28th was my 20th wedding anniversary, and I was writing that column.
Wedding anniversary.
Do you mind? Do you mind? I have to get this out.
I'm on a roll.
So what we've heard a lot about Danielle is, oh my gosh, we're going to have a repeat of 2010. Yeah. Right. We're going to have a repeat of 2010 when Tom Tancredo came in and tanked the vote because he ran on the Constitution Party ticket.
Against Dan Mays. He tanked
against Dan Mays. Correct. What they hope that you don't think about is that Tancredo got 36% of the vote and Dan Mays got 11. Right. And so I wasn't here in 2010. I was in the Tea Party in Florida at the time. I moved here in 2012. I went to CU. I lived here with my husband, prior to moving back to Florida, but I came back in 2012. And so I don't have the emotional bias of that time period. Right. I didn't live through it. They weren't my candidates. I didn't have a dog in the fight. I'm looking at from, purely kind of a forensic point of view, what happened.
Right.
And with that lens, what I see is that the Republican Party refused to align with their base, with the conservatives that actually make up the vote, the electorate. Right.
Well, and what they did is, it was, I've tweeted about this too. It was their fault, right? The base clearly wanted Tom Tancredo. And they're like, oh, he's too extreme, too extreme. So they support Scott McGinnis, who turned out to be a horrible candidate, crashed and burned. So Dan Mays was what was left after that fight. I mean, I don't think anybody would have said, oh yeah, we support Dan Mays, but then they were stuck with him. I mean, I agree with you. They created the Republican establishment, by ignoring the base, created that situation.
No, I guess I wouldn't agree, because I was very much involved. And Tom is a great friend of mine. But if the old song about know when to hold them and know when to fold them. Well, Tom has schizophrenia on that or whatever, bipolar or something. I mean, he's always running when he shouldn't. and he's always getting out when he should stay in. And in 2010, he was not going to win as long as Dan Mays stayed in there. And the Republican establishment didn't particularly support Dan Mays.
No, but I mean, if they had let Tom Tancredo run in the first place.
He didn't want to run. Well, he refused to run. He only ran because he didn't think he could beat McGinnis. He only got it when Mays got it. Mays was such a disaster. So it wasn't quite as simple.
You're right.
If Tom had run from the beginning, he would have won the nomination, but he got in too late. And just, you know, the election before that, he gets in. He gets the nomination and then folds. I mean, come on, Tommy.
But to further, though, your column is you kind of say, look, the situation we have here. I mean, I think what you go ahead and just talk about what you suggest.
So the, you know, kind of subtext and the part of this story that at the time contemporaneous press really latched onto, excuse me, the leftist press. Was that the Republican Party, because their candidate only got 11% of the vote, they were in danger, right? You have to have at least 10% of the vote or you're a minority party. In comparison, the Constitution Party, which was a minority party prior, and the trend of minority parties in this state is about 1.9%, right? Okay. Of the vote over since 2015, it's about 1.9%. So the minority party of the Constitution Party got the 36%. They became a majority party in the state because of that, because it was a governor candidate. And that's how it's determined in the state of Colorado. And the Republican Party was in danger of becoming a minority party. I think it would have been great had that happened, not because they would have stayed a minority party, but because maybe they would have learned their lesson, because clearly they have not learned their lesson, as evidenced by the, you know, I go back to that radio show, which I found so, I'm not even a Republican, right? That they weren't talking about me, but I found it so deeply offensive when you look at the results. And I talk about this in the piece that I wrote on the Assembly, and also in the column that I wrote for Glendale Cherry Creek. You had 61% of Republican delegates vote for Tina Peters,
right?
A vote for Tina Peters is absolutely a vote for election integrity, because unless you believe in what she did, then you have to view her as a criminal if you're an honest broker, right? And I try to assume that people are honest brokers. That's, you know, not always smart, but so a vote for Tina Peters is a vote for election integrity. And the Republican Party had an opportunity at that moment when they saw that 61% of their delegates voted for Tina Peters. They had an opportunity to shift. They had an opportunity to realign with the base, and the Republican Party had an opportunity to avoid what happened in 2010. Instead, the Republican Party maintains their attitude of, you know, we know best. Right. And we're going to do it the way that we want to do it. What did they do? Did they come out and talk about the great results for, you know, election? No. What did they do? They came out and they berated and dismissed and disavowed 61% of their delegates.
Well, and they let Kyle Clark from Channel 9 bully them, right? I mean, look at Chuck was talking earlier, the 2000 Mules is debuting, right? On Dinesh D'Souza's documentary on election integrity.
I'm going to see it tonight.
It's sold out. We were going to go and we can't get in. It's sold out.
A friend
right?
of mine bought tickets right when they announced it, which is the only reason, because I would be sold out too.
Right. When they try to pretend like this is because they don't want to have mean tweets aimed at them, that this is some obscure fringe thing that no one believes in. I mean, I would just say to all of them, I would say to Christy Burton Brown, all those people, go watch it. You know, Peter Boyles, go watch it. Just watch it and then come back and talk to me, right? But don't just tell me there's no basis. And I think you're right. It's like they just keep saying, no, la, 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 can't see or hear anything, you know, and it's not working.
No,
it's not working. We're not winning.
It's working totally. Wow. All they care about is controlling one of the two major parties. In this case, the Republican Party. The fact the Republican Party has, you know, five state senators left and 10 House members left, they could care less, because they can always make a deal. They can always get money from the government by going to polls and say, let's do a bipartisan deal. Sort of like the LEAP thing. I mean, they all were going to make a fortune out of it. Right. So the mere fact that they're destroying the Republican Party, the other one, if they back Tina Peters and Ron Hanks and the other people where they said we have a unity message, they would lose it to the grassroots, because the grassroots are much more numerous than the establishment. So it's not illogic.
And involved.
Yeah, yes. It's not illogic. It's just unadulterated greed.
Well, and I think, go ahead.
Well, I was just going to say, we don't even have to look at the assembly or the way that they're managing their party. Just look at where they put their priorities. So you have Colorado grassroots around election integrity is one of the most on fire populations in the nation. We have made such waves through the legislature, the triple communist majority legislature, where we've had Matt Crane have to come out and address substance of reports because our pressure campaign is so effective, right? Election integrity is 100% important to the base of the Republican Party. Over the past couple of weeks, we've seen Christy Burton Brown and establishment Republicans go all out in social media, in messaging everywhere about the fentanyl bill.
Right. Right.
Have we heard them talk about SB 22-153, which is on the House floor right now?
A little bit,
but you're right. But they don't talk about why it matters. They just
Before we came on, I checked Christy Burton Brown, specifically her Twitter, because I follow her and I saw all of her fentanyl posts, right? There were loads of them. She tweeted more about that than she has about anything. Not a single post about 22-153.
I will give her
not a priority.
I'll give her this. Yeah, I've gotten an email. One, I'll say one. But you're right though. What she doesn't do is it's just kind of vague. I think what they're trying to do is split the baby. Right? They get that. Oh, okay. There do seem to be a lot of people here who care about this. So we're going to talk about it. But then we're still going to talk about all those election deniers. Right? I mean, they're trying to have it both ways.
So forget Christie's tweets then, right? We have it. I'm monitoring the House floor right now. It hasn't come up yet, but they are supposed to have 22-153 hit the floor for the third reading today. I have spoken to a few of my sources in the legislature who are going to do everything that they can to delay it, but there is no political will on behalf of the leadership in the House to address it at all. To do anything, to filibuster, to do anything.
I mean, this is a missed
opportunity to realign with the people of their base, and they are the ones who are repeating 2010.
And I think I read somewhere that some Republicans were planning to try to do a lengthy filibuster. But remember all the publicity and everything they did on the abortion bill, right? Mm-hmm. And they the longest ever, you know, I mean, you're right. There is no, you know, come help us, support us on this bill. Nothing like that. Right. Yeah. And, I think in your column, it was this interesting. Well, what if Danielle Neuschwanger ran in the Constitution Party and got another 36%. And I mean, you know, it raises some interesting possibilities. And
well, the other part about it is, you know, the Constitutional Party got promoted to major party status and they hated it.
They complained immediately about it. Right. But what if they were?
Well, that'd be great because we wouldn't have an open primary anymore. We could go back to an agenda primary. In fact, that should be required to have unless we voted otherwise. Going back to minority status would be the greatest thing the Republican Party could do. Honestly, it would. It'd be tremendous because then all of a sudden you'd have and then whoever the assembly picked out would have huge support throughout the state. It may not win. It may win depending if they can do some ballot harvesting themselves. But the Republican Party turning into a minority party would be the best thing that could possibly happen. So if Danielle went, and you know, Heidi is a nice person, but she's everything establishment, everything.
Yeah.
Everything.
Well, it's just not going to, I mean, frankly, I kind of think it's a very difficult road for any Republican gubernatorial candidate at this point. But again, you raise an interesting possibility. And it all goes back to, I think, what you've said and what we've said and what all of our people here on chat and our listeners, say is they're not listening to us. And somehow or another, then when we kind of speak up our mind and 61% of us vote for Tina Peters, they freak out and say, well, we don't like you anymore. You know, we're not going to give you money.
Wait till you see the emails come out of Pam Anderson wins the primary, which is the heavy favorite. they'll go unify behind our wonderful candidate. We all
get together,
you know, and Dick Wadsworth, we have to unify.
It's coming. That message is definitely coming. And I'll tell you, I see that someone in the chat said, you know, it's the economy, stupid. It's not election integrity. I appreciate it. I understand the long history that mentality and ideology has with elections. That is fundamentally, I believe, untrue in 2022. I think that the stolen election of 2020 fundamentally changed the electorate. The Republican Party does not carry the value that it used to, certainly in the state of Colorado, but in the nation in general.
Well, if the economy matters, then Polis will be out, but he's not out. He's not going to be out because starting in 2013, they've rigged the election. We didn't have to, by 2018, they had already established their ballot harvesting machine to make sure we can't win. And the idea that people are going to, we're going to win now, you know, if anything becomes threatened, if Polis becomes threatened in a poll, he'll pull out another 30 million. And ballot harvest his way to victory. And the Republicans, it's just...
Keep pretending that doesn't happen.
Well, there's an article in Gateway Pundit how the Republican Party in Alaska gave up a red state in order to have ranked voting and jungle primaries and everything else, combination of moderate Republicans and Democrats. Yep. Well, that's what they've done here, but over a longer period of time. The moderate Republicans, the Dick Wadhams, the Bill Owens, they've all trashed us so they can continue to run the Republican Party, and the weaker it gets, they could care less.
And that's why, to the voters, to the electorate, to the people of Colorado, in particular the conservatives of Colorado and people who feel like the Republican Party has left them, that's why I think this game is different now. If you're going to keep voting, right, the Republican Party is running the opposite direction of its base.
Yes.
And you just laid out, since 2013, we've seen this, them continue, right? It's this trying to be more like Democrats to grab the middle, right? And that hasn't worked for the Republican Party, because since 2015, they've been hemorrhaging members. In the column you mentioned, I have the voting data over time as a chart in that article, and they've been hemorrhaging members since 2015. The more they go to the middle, the fewer people want to be a part of it. And at the same time, we see Democrats hemorrhaging members at the same rate. The theory among Republicans and Democrats is that unaffiliated voters vote like Democrats, and so we have to become more like Democrats to grab the middle in Colorado. That's not true. I believe, both parties have abandoned the American people, and the American people are in the middle.
Yeah, yeah. Well, what's happened is, you know, if you get illegal votes, if you get votes from Alzheimer's patients and old age homes, they don't care if you're middle, not middle. They're going to vote whoever the ballot harvesters say.
Well, and here, real quick, to Leo, and then we got to go. Leo is saying, Ash, tell me how you're going to get to election integrity. And Leo, I'll answer that. Number one, you need to clean out the voter rolls. Number two, you need to have ballot harvesting rules that are in place and enforced.
Get rid of ballot harvesting.
What I mean, where you can only have one. That's what I mean. And so that's a place to start. We'll talk about this more. Golly, guys, these columns are great here, but we got to run. So Ash, thank you. Ash in America.
Ash. Great to see you.
Ash in America, the Glendale Cherry Creek Chronicle 2. We'll see you next time. Thank you for your time.
Thanks.
All right. Bye-bye. Bye, everybody. All right. Oh, God. So we'll address some of the comments later, because this is a big topic. Yeah, so how are we going to fix it? Hey, thank you to John St. Augustine. Thank you to Ash, at Ash in America, to Thomas, all you great guys on Zoom. Remember, you can get links to the show on any podcast format you want, Rumble at chuckandjulie.com.
And I'll go back to the Jeff Amber.
Chuck is now going to go back. Album is over. It's probably over now.
I've got seven more minutes.
You guys, we'll see you all on Party Friday. We'll see you then.